Alcoholic. My name is Mike Steele. I want to thank Dale for inviting me to come here and share my story with you folks. I will tell you, this is a far cry from the place in the crowd where I told my story for the first time. There used to be a place up here in Elk Run called the Pig Farm. I don't know if any of you folks remember that, but that's where they had me speak first, and it was real dark, and I was probably 3 or 4 months sober, and there was only 5 people there. The room was about this size. They were all sitting in the back. You could barely see them back there. They didn't want to be there. That's the idea. So they weren't volunteers. So at any rate, let me start by getting a couple of things right out of the way. My last drink was in May of 1980. I didn't come to AA till January of 81. But I have not had a drink or a drug since that time. Drugs are not part of my story, and even if they were, I wouldn't talk about them in an AA meeting. Come from a good family. My mother, I don't think, ever had a drink. My father drank a beer from time to time. So no problem there. My other side of the family, they were all alcoholic. I do have a couple of uncles, or did have a couple of uncles, that got sober before me. My younger sister got sober before I did. So I had been around AA, but nonetheless, I'd like to read a couple of things. I'm a firm believer in our literature, and I'd like to read a couple of things that certainly say it better than I can. We're told to share in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and that's what I'm going to try to do. Let me start by saying, I started drinking my home group is Amosville, closed Monday night, 7:30 meeting. And I attend meetings regularly. I always have. I'm convinced that's helped me stay pretty much even keel. When I first came to AA, I was raised, like I say, by a good family. My folks taught us to think for ourselves, to be independent, and the men in my, I was raised around plenty of women, and we were taught to respect women. I have 4 sisters. I have 4 daughters. I have 6 granddaughters. And so now I have some brothers and grandsons too, but we were taught early on by my father, who was a drill instructor in the Marine Corps, that you respected, you protected, and you provided for those less fortunate. And so that and family was the most important thing, period. So I believed all that, and I still do to this day. So I'm telling you, it wasn't like they said, this is the kid we're going to screw up. It wasn't like that. I was not a kid who came up thinking that I was somehow didn't fit in or inadequate. Listen, I was a good athlete. I had lots of girlfriends. I was at ease with myself. But all through my life, there's been one thing. And that thing was, I always had this vague dissatisfaction. Is this all there is? Before I ever started drinking, no matter how good things were, is this all there is? And that kind of clouded my life. At any rate, I will tell you in a general way what it was like. I started drinking when I was about 14 or 15, probably 13 or 14, just casual, a couple of beers with the guys. I wasn't old enough to buy beer, and there wasn't any alcohol in my house. We'd have a couple of beers. I didn't particularly like the taste of it, but, you go along with the boys and so forth. And so I did that. And by the way, Dale said, jacket and tie, no cussing, no spitting, and be done by 5 till 7. I got everything covered but that. You could be here longer. Anyway, he said, got married my high school sweetheart. We were 17 years old. We had a child right away. I started drinking at that time, more often than I had, certainly. I would drink at least weekly. I didn't start out the first 6 months or so drinking alcoholic, but it didn't take long. My whole drinking career was over by the time I was 30, and I packed everything that happens to alcoholics during that period of time. I lost jobs. I was hospitalized. I was institutionalized. I was arrested many times. I was not an international jewel thief. I was a drunk. And so I got arrested for stupid things. I was always drunk in something. Drunk driving, drunk in public, vagrancy. I got the very first time I ever got arrested, I was 15 years old. It was for vagrancy. And I had already moved out of my father's home. And so when they called my father, he hung up on me. And they called him back. And he said he got himself in there, let him get himself out. And that's how we were brought up. And that was okay with me. At any rate, so here I am, athletic, I guess reasonably good looking. I had long black hair then. And so you see what alcoholism will do for you. Take that to mind, fellas. Look at Mike back there. And so at any rate, so we get married. I start drinking a little too much. My wife was raised by alcoholics. And this was my high school sweetheart. And I'm going to tell you right now, she was a doll. She was a beautiful woman. She was a great mother, a great wife. I can't blame anything on her. She might have been a bit of an enabler, but that would be kind of go par for the course. She probably wouldn't have married a drunk if she wasn't. And so she said to me one time, and I remember clearly, I was about 19 years old. She said, "You're going to end up an alcoholic just like my parents." And I said, "I only drink beer. That's impossible. You can't be an alcoholic drinking beer." And I said, "Your folks drink hard liquor." She said, "Well, you may or may not graduate to hard liquor, but you are heading towards alcoholism." And so there is a line that I would like to read you very quickly, not to get off track, but I think it's important to note this. If I can find, oh, here. I have some of you may have known a longtime sponsor of mine, Francis X, and he and I would tell him things and he would say, "Read this." This is from A Comes of Age. It says, "Inwardly, the alcoholic brooks no control from man or God. He, the alcoholic, is and must be the master of his destiny. He will fight to the end to preserve that position. Defiantly individualistic with grandiosity that brooks no control from man or God." And that described me. Now, I didn't believe it at the time, but that described me perfectly. So I didn't believe that was going to happen to me. But my drinking quickly turned into, I told you I had all this respect for women. If you'd asked me what was the most important thing in my life, I'd have said my family. That obviously was not the case. I drank my way out. I had, before that marriage was over, I had four daughters, so I loved very much. I loved my wife very much. But that respect that I would claim and that importance of family obviously didn't hold much water. This was before cell phones. And by the time I was 21 years old, I had numerous car accidents, motorcycle accidents. I had been hospitalized and in critical condition from car accidents and motorcycle accidents. And I did all the stupid things that alcoholics do early on. It was like I knew what to do as an alcoholic. I rode motorcycles my whole life. I was drunk one night. I hit a car broadside. I got torn up pretty good, but I recovered enough so that within a year, I had gotten drunk on that another motorcycle and ran into an apartment building. And it wasn't because I didn't see it. It was because I was too drunk to hit the brakes. And I went over the curb, through the bushes, down the hill, and bam, into the side of a, well, it happened to be the apartment building I lived in at the time. So it worked out. I just climbed out from under it and went inside. And the next morning, my wife said, "You know your motorcycle's against the building." And I said, "Yeah." And I said, "I was too drunk to get it out of there." And so she was fast approaching. This wasn't going to continue this way. in her opinion. But this respect I had, supposedly, we didn't have cell phones. I would leave to go to work on a Monday morning. I was in the car business by this time. I'd been in construction. I'd done a little bit of everything. And I went in the car business, and I would go to work on Monday morning, worked in a big shop, 60 guys in the shop. And by noon, lunchtime, I'd go to lunch with a couple of the boys. They'd all go back to work, and I'd stay in the beer joint. And I might not come home, or I definitely wouldn't go back to work, but I might not come home for 2 or 3 days. No phone call, no nothing. So much for that idea that I respect my wife. So this, my behavior was like that almost all the time. And even my drinking buddy said, Jesus, you should quit drinking. He said, you of all of us, you're the one that shouldn't be drinking. And I'm not going to go into a lot of adventures that I had. I had some good times drinking. Certainly, I did love my family. I worship my daughters. But I was moving away from all that. My alcoholism was taking me away from all of that. I had many people wish me well. I mean, they would think they were giving me good advice. My father, of all people, took me aside one time. I must have been about 24, 5 years old. And he said, Mike, well, in his hand, you have a great job, and I don't know how, but you have a wife who loves you to death. You have 4 daughters who worship you. And in this hand, you have drinking. You're going to have to make a choice. Obviously, I made my choice. My wife left and took those daughters with her. I lost my home, my marriage, my family. Everything I said was the most important thing, but I was not willing to stop drinking. It came to a point I couldn't stop drinking, and that happened early on for me. It didn't matter that I said, well, I did go one time, I think, for 6 weeks without a drink, but nobody did you want to be around during that period of time. Let me read something. I was told early on that the answer to every problem I had is in the big book, and I didn't believe that either. But I found that that is absolutely the case. And over the years, I found that out. And when we say what happened, lots of things happened. I mean, as far as giving me a reason to take a look at my behavior. Not to spend a lot of time on a drunk alone, but I will tell you, I was at work one Saturday. My in-laws, I've been married 3 times. All my in-laws love me. My wives must not have so all that much, because I've been single a long time now. But my in-laws were coming from West Virginia to have dinner. It was on a Saturday afternoon, and I didn't technically work Saturdays, but I had a side job, and I worked Saturdays that Saturday. And my buddy who I was riding with, we leave, and I call from work, and I said, I'll be there by 5 o'clock in time to get cleaned up for your folks for dinner. She said, okay, good. But on the way, we didn't get 2 blocks from the shop, and there were these 2 young ladies hitchhiking. So our civic duty was to give them a ride. And about 3 days later, I showed up at home. My in-laws came from West Virginia. No regard. Alcohol, once I took that first drink of alcohol, it was over for me. What it says is the fact that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against that first drink. That was me. That described me. Many times I would get out of jail, the emergency room. I would swear to God and mean it. I'm not going to drink today. Not today. By the afternoon, there's a magic hour. Everybody's a little different. Mine was about 3 o'clock. By 3 o'clock, I'd forgotten all about that other stuff. Nothing mattered now except to have a beer. I said, every guy that works hard as I do deserves to have a beer. They don't usually end up in Baltimore in jail and not know how they got there then. But I did. I would, this is the kind of, my behavior was that way almost from the beginning. In the doctor's opinion, which I love, it says that we are restless, irritable, and discontented my whole life. Unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks. That's the truth for me. Once the psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving them, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol. The only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. That's a tough thing for me, for many alcoholics, apparently. At any rate, so my drinking, as you can see, is completely out of control. My behavior is out of control. I had crashed a car. We were leaving the 1320 Club, which was a joint down on Route 1. Was as drunk as I could be, and I got in my car and promptly ran into a phone pole. And I was at a high rate of speed, and I went through the windshield. And when I did, I was cut up pretty bad, and they put me in the hospital, and they did some surgery on me, so forth. Well, when they released me, I was wrapped up like a mummy. Now, by this time, I had accumulated what my mother used to call a lot of shady friends. And I was home for about 2 days recovering from all this. And this group of shady friends came by on the motorcycles and said, "We're all going down to such and such beer joint. You want to go?" I said, "Well, I can't go like this." I said, "But take the bandages off." Now I looked like Frankenstein, you know. They took the bandages off. I got on my motorcycle. We went drinking and riding. During this period of time, my wife, again, was leaning towards having had enough. One morning, I went in with my brother, one of my brothers. We went into, I got home about 3 in the morning, and I promptly woke her up and asked her to get up and fix us some breakfast. She promptly got up and stabbed me. True story. I saw it coming, so I ran. So she got me in the back. And after a while, because I was good at smooth talking these things, and I would talk my way back into the house, back into the big bed. "It'll never happen again, honey." Well, I asked her when I finally felt safe. I said, "Why'd you stab me?" She said, "Because I couldn't find my gun." Thank God for that. At any rate, again, it was none of this was her fault. My drinking took off almost from the beginning, as you can tell. There's a million episodes like this. I mean, literally hundreds of these incidents, these episodes. It wouldn't do any good to bore you with all of them, but I will tell you, I had some adventures. And I was what you might call a traveling drunk. Anytime I'd get to drinking, I'd want to go somewhere. And I had started heading for Florida many times, and I never made it out of Stafford County. But one time I came to, and I did have a lot of blackouts. I came to, and I was in Hawaii. I thought, "Where in the hell am I?" Well, there was a woman with me. And I said, "Where are we?" She said, "We're in Hawaii." She said, "Thank you. I've always wanted to go there." I said, "Who are you?" Anyway, and so, I promptly called my wife. Let her know it's been a problem. I'll be home as soon as possible. So I was, this was my behavior though. And I could not drink. No matter what I said, I could not take that first drink. And once I took the first drink, it was over. It was not a case that sometimes it was over. It was always over for me. Once I took the first drink, I was not going to stop drinking until I couldn't drink anymore. I was way past the point of having hangovers. I was at we my job, we could drink on the job, so I did. I drank all the time. I can't tell you how many occasions I missed with my family, with my daughters, with their milestones, my folks, all the people around me. I always felt like the most self-centered statement an alcoholic can make is, "I'm not hurting anybody but myself." I hurt everybody around me. In some way, I affected them all. The good news is, if you get sober and stay sober, that affects them all also. And I believe that sobriety is progressive, and we do have an influence on our families and our friends and the people we come in contact. My sponsor would say, Mike, if I want to know how you're working the 10 step, I'll go down to Safeway and ask the cashiers, because it's true. How do I treat other people? But I'm getting a little ahead of myself. So I met this guy at Bull Run Country Jamboree. Some of you may be familiar with that. And he and I drank about the same, and he lived close to me, and we hit it off, and we were drinking, and all of a sudden, very abruptly, he stopped drinking. I said, Frank, what's going on with you? He said, I can't take it anymore. Said, okay, I'm tougher than you are. I can keep doing it. So we're still good friends, but about this time, my wife got into Al-Anon. And that was a problem for me, because my wife would come get me no matter where I was, in jail, lost my car, didn't matter. I'd call, she'd come get me. So at this point, she was in Al-Anon. I just tried to turn a blind eye to it, except she would go on vacation with the kids, and she'd put a big book in the refrigerator on top of my beer. And I tossed those things out, you know, and again, my sister was already in a age sober. And so I had been exposed a little bit, you know, and she needed it for sure. So this woman started showing up at my house, and it turned out it was my wife's Al-Anon sponsor. Well, it turned out it was my buddy's wife. And I knew her, and I said, I couldn't take it. So I called Frank, and I said, Frank, you know, I've read the first step in AA. And I said, my life is unmanageable, probably. I mean, excuse me, I am powerless over alcohol, and my wife is unmanageable. I said, I can't do anything with her. And I said, you can't do anything about yours either. You've got to do something. She's ruining my life. I said, you've got to get her under control. He said, Mike, you ought to try living with her. I said, well, I got enough headaches. But my wife was a turning point. She wasn't going to put up with this nonsense anymore. Because as I said, I could go on for hours of all this shenanigans I pulled due to drinking. When I wasn't drinking, I didn't do this stuff. I didn't do any of this stuff when I wasn't drinking. And so, but I was drinking all the time, and that was the problem. So here she is going to Al-Anon. She no longer has it, basically has nothing to do with me. I lived in the same house, but I would rarely see her or the kids anymore. And so all this time, I knew there was something more than this, than what I was living. I've always known that it had to be something different. There had to be something more. I was always dissatisfied. And when I wasn't drinking, I was a pretty happy-go-lucky guy. But when I was drinking, I could be pretty ornery. And I'd had run-ins with all my family, not just my immediate family, but my aunts and uncles and cousins. And we were all close. But they got to where they didn't invite me to these big family gatherings anymore because they didn't know what to expect. And one of them told me that one day. I said, well, hell, I don't know what to expect, because I didn't. And I was being honest for, you know, for once. So finally, this was not a horrendous drunk like I'd been on many times. I was in my truck. I had stopped and got six beers, and I used to help a guy on his farm, and I had just left his house, picked up six beers. I was on my way home, and I had drank a couple of them, and it just hit me. I can't live like this anymore. I don't know what to do. I was never affiliated with any church, religion, but I cried out. I cried out. I said, God help me. I don't know what to do. And the compulsion and the obsession was lifted from me right then, just like that. I didn't know how to live sober, though. So that's what I say. I didn't come to AA till 6, 7 months later, after this occurrence. And I didn't have that compulsion to drink after that. I didn't really know what to attribute it to, except I cried out to God. I didn't know what else to do. So I did. I cried out to God. But I didn't know how to live. So when I was miserable enough as a white knuckling, dry drunk, I called that same guy and I said, "You still going to those meetings?" He said, "Yeah, I'll meet you over at the church and blah, blah, blah." And that was the beginning for me. That was the beginning of my real life, of a second opportunity, a chance at life that I never would have had. And I tell you, it wasn't always easy. It hasn't been. I was still married to that woman for a couple of years, and she decided that I was a lot more fun when I was drinking. So she left. And originally she left, and I said, "You can go, but you can't take my daughters." So I had my four daughters. I don't know if I knew what I was getting into, raising four daughters on my own. But I didn't have to figure it out too much, because about 3 years later, she came back in the picture and took me to court and took those girls from me. Not because I was an unfit father, but because that's what the courts did back then. The daughters should be with their mother, even though that she there was a lot of evidence that she shouldn't be raising kids by this time. So I made a lot of the initial mistakes I think most alcoholics were prone to in their early sobriety. First off, I wouldn't listen to anybody. I had a sponsor, but I would say to him, "You don't understand." Or I would say, "Well, this is different." And he'd just shake his head. Said, "Mm-hmm." And he said to me, he said, "You know, you're the problem." That didn't mean much to me until early on, a friend of mine said to me, he was complaining about his sponsor. And I was going to meetings on a regular basis. I did not want to. I was not somebody got here and said, "Hallelujah, I'm home." I did not. I sat in the back like I was telling him. I said, "They told me you have to get the meetings early. Otherwise, the good seats are taken and you'll have to sit all the way up front." So I made sure I got there early enough to get a seat in the back row. But slowly they drug me up, and I owe my early sobriety especially to the men who grabbed me, took me under their wing, who gave me guidance, whether I wanted it or not. So at any rate, I think I lost my train of thought there for a second about where I was going with that. But I will tell you, I would go. Oh, it was about 9 months into sobriety. Attending AA meetings on a regular basis, still hating it, and sitting in the back row counting all these floor tile, all the ceiling tile. There was a great big meeting in Manassas at the time at the Big Baptist Church on Thursday night. And there might be 200 people there for a speaker's meeting every Thursday. And they bring these circuit speakers in, you know, these big name speakers who were very entertaining. But they all had a good message. Finally, these guys grabbed me and said, and we were still smoking back then, and said, "You're going to be given the job of cleaning these ashtrays." I said, "I'm not cleaning those nasty things." They said, "Yes, you are." So I did. I made a clean ashtrays. There's 200 ashtrays. They're big old glass things, you know. It's like you don't have to go to the gym if you do all that. So they got me involved in that fashion. But it was about 9 months into it, I called my sponsor at the time. I said, "If you tell this to anybody, I'm going to swear you made it up. But I'm going to tell you something. I'm looking forward to going to meetings." But something changed. I said, "I'm starting to look forward to going to meetings." Now, it didn't hurt that there were some very, I was 30 years old. There were some very attractive young women in these meetings. So that didn't hurt my feelings a bit. One of them, and this is how these men helped me. One of these ladies was what we used to call an exotic dancer. And she said one night in a meeting, my sponsor was sitting on one side. I mean, this other very good friend of mine sitting on the other side. She said, "I don't believe I can stay sober tonight if I don't have a man." So I stood up. I said, "Well, I feel like it's my AA duty." They sat me back down. And that was that. So I had good guidance. I had good direction. And because another friend of ours took her up on it, and they've both been drunk ever since. And one of the, and that fella is local. Mike knows him, and he came back for a little while, but he's never managed to get sober really for any length of time since. I don't blame it on her, obviously, but at any rate, so I still had that irritable discontent, that unsettled feeling. So I heard a speaker one time say, you can go to all the meetings you want to. You don't drink. Everybody's patting you on the back. Oh, you're doing good, Mike. You're looking good, man. Keep it up. And you're going to want to go home and blow your brains out. Because if you're not working the steps, you haven't changed a thing. And I learned so much from the other men and things that they've said to me. One of my best friends my whole life got sober before I did. He's dead now, but he said, Mike, you can dress up a trash can, but it's still a trash can. It's still full of garbage. And I was full of garbage. I'd done some things. I'd done a lot of things that were tough to live with. They weren't all necessarily great big things, but they were still tough for me to live with. I went against all my values. I had no integrity. It did not matter what I told you. I only told you what was convenient for me at the time. I would tell you whatever you wanted to hear and do whatever I wanted to do. It was, and it showed up in every aspect of my life, that my self-centeredness, my obsession with alcohol, ruled my life. It was always that what about me stuff. And it took a while for that to change. When I was sober for, I don't know, a year or so, I said to my sponsor, I said, you know, I was feeling that kind of discontent. And I said, where's my parade? Where's my $1 million? He said, what? I said, I haven't had a drink in a year. He said, oh my God. He said, you're just doing what everybody else does anyway. And they don't want an award for it, and you shouldn't either. And he was right. But I had to get that self-centeredness, you know, I had to get past that. But this idea that I was the problem, this friend of mine said to me, he said, Mike, my sponsor really got me beside myself. I said, why is that? He said, I call him and he never answers the phone. I said, well, does he call you back? He said, yeah, he calls me right back. And I said, well, I don't get the problem, Kevin. He said, well, it's the phone message. I said, what's the phone message? He says, this is Bill. I can't take your call right now, but I'll leave you a message. I'll call right back. But Kevin, if this is you, you're the problem. And it hit home with me. I thought, I'm not calling my sponsor anymore. Because I knew what he was going to say. And I made a couple of extremely poor decisions in my early sobriety because I would not take guidance. One of them was I got married. And I don't say anything against marriage and sobriety, but this one it was, and this went very bad very quick, and it cost me a lot. It cost me everything, actually, and so like, and I'd been advised against it too soon, blah blah blah, all the stuff that we hear today. But I was, there's that defiance. My whole life has been marked by defiance. And I can be arrogant while I'm defiant. And so I didn't listen and I paid the price. But I learned a lesson, very valuable lesson. But I've never been given any bad advice in AA. And so we have this new design for living, as the book says. And I believe that. So what do I do about it? I'm not going to walk you through the steps because that would take forever. And I really will end up on time. But I have had many I would consider spiritual awakenings. I've had times that I have to look at myself honestly. I've been sober for almost 44 years, but I still have to look at my own behavior. I can still start veering towards the self-centeredness, the egotistic attitudes. the judge being judgmental. And I can tell you that what helps me the most is working with other alcoholics. I have to remember that I'm only reason I'm here. And I asked an old timer one time, I said, why am I even here? He said, you only have one purpose, Mike. He said, it's to carry the message. He said, you just worry about that. You carry the message to the newcomer who still suffers. That's the purpose of our groups, and that's our primary purpose as an individual. And I've always tried to live by that because it's selfish. I reap what I sow. That didn't come out of this big book. But I found that the more I give, the more I get. So it can be selfish in that sense. I've tried to do that in every, I'm now retired, but even in my business career, my working career, I tried to do that always. I always tried to live by A principles. But it didn't start out that way. It took me 2 or 3 years, maybe a little longer. A guy told me early on, he said, it takes 5 years to get happy. I said, oh, Jesus, I don't think I can wait that long. And it really didn't. But if there was one of the things that was so important to me early on was I got sober with five guys, two, not the restaurant, the two guys I worked with. And one of them was one of my oldest, rowdiest drinking buddies. We were all over the country together on drunks. And we worked together. We saw each other every day. He was a shop foreman. And one day he said, I can't be running around with you anymore. I said, what's going on, Murph? He said, I'll quit drinking. I said, okay, that'll last about a half hour. But he didn't drink. And every day we had this little routine. I'd say, Murph, he said, nope, still not drinking. When I'd had enough, I didn't tell him I was not drinking. I didn't tell him I was going to AA. It was obvious that something was changing. And we had this third guy I worked with, and he came to me one day. I'd probably been sober, I don't know, 6 months. No, maybe a little longer than that, not much, maybe a year. And he said, Mike, I can't, and he was one of my drinking buddies and one of my hunting buddies. And he said, I can't take it anymore. He said, will you help me get sober? I said, sure. I said, I'll take you to an AA meeting tonight. He said, I have to work tonight. I said, Murph was a shop foreman. He was the guy who had already gotten sober. I said, go tell Murph you have to go somewhere with me. So he tells Murph, and Murph grabs him by the shirt collar and drags him up to where I was. And he says, are you two guys going to an AA meeting? I said, yeah, actually we are. I said, good, I'll go with you. And he'd been in AA for over a year by this time. But he wouldn't tell me, and I wouldn't tell him. When we were drinking, we told each other everything. God help us. We weren't going to say, you know, I'm gotten sober. I always remember this guy said to me, wait a minute. You don't want to go to that meeting because you think you're running into somebody you know. He said, you're the guy who would pass out in your front yard in your underwear. And your neighbor's walking by. He said, and you think you're being embarrassed for them to know you're getting some help? So you better rethink that. But I think that's alcoholism. I think that's, but I didn't have this God. I didn't have a God. I knew that something was there because I was relieved of this compulsion, this obsession. But I didn't know what. I didn't know how to find it. I basically had to do I had to follow instructions. I was told to pray as if I knew what I was doing. So I did. I prayed. One of the things I prayed for was a new red Electroglide. Now, at the time, I was almost living in my car. I was so broke. And it was a yellow Vega. And nobody wants to live in a yellow Vega. And I had been chasing this woman around. She was sober some length of time, and I told her what had happened to me. I had this revelation. I was at a stoplight, and this red Electroglide pulled up next to me. And I said, I took that as a sign from God. She said, you did? I said, yeah. She said, aren't you broke? I said, oh, very much. She said, maybe you should call your sponsor. No. I don't call my sponsor. I know what he's going to say. And she said to me, she said, you know, you're just a baby in sobriety. Oh, my God. I was 2 years sober. I thought, do you know who you're talking to? Well, she did, obviously. And because I was a baby in sobriety. But I had to delve into these steps, and I had to find a power greater than myself. I had to develop a relationship with my God, with the God of my understanding, not anybody else's. I don't care what anybody else's is. I don't even care if you don't have one personally, but I know I have to have one. I have to have a relationship in my darkest times. And I lost a sister. I've lost both my parents. So I was very close to my parents. My father and I used to fight fist fights when I was drinking, and I made my amends. We put that to rest to the extent that he was building himself a house. I took 6 months off my job and spent that 6 months helping him build this house. I went and had breakfast with my folks every Sunday morning until the day they died after that. And they lived 50 miles away. But it was never too big a burden because of what I'd put them through when I was young. And believe me, my parents suffered because of my alcoholism. My mother would wring her hands and she'd say, what are we going to do with you? And she was the famous saying was, what were you thinking? And I'd say, I didn't think I'd get caught or I wouldn't have done it, because that was the truth. I wouldn't do things if I thought I'd get caught. But unfortunately, I don't have a good gauge of what I'm going to get caught when I'm not. So I was constantly in trouble. The police were coming and going at my house. And so I put them through hell. So I made my amends, but I started getting into these steps, and I started developing a relationship with a God of my understanding, who I have come to depend on daily, many times during the day. Many times I will pray for guidance, for the strength. And things have always worked out since then, since I've spent the time concentrated or developed this relationship with the God of my understanding. But I don't want to tell you that I get direct messages. I don't. What I do have is a group of men. See, I wanted to have a group of women when I first got sober. But I had a group of men because that's what was stressed to me. Stay away from the women. And I have developed this group of men who I confide in, who I talk to on a regular basis, and I run these things by them, whether I like it or not. And I do that because I believe in it. I believe it works. I heard years ago, they said that God leaves messages for me all over town, but I have to go to meetings to pick them up. And I found that to be true. At this point in my sobriety, sometimes I will say, I've heard it all. There's nothing left for me to hear. And then I get a comeuppance. And I hear something, I think, wow, why have I never heard that? I heard something very recently. A lady said, I was in a meeting with this, and this lady, I didn't know her. She said, she had asked an old timer, what part of this program is spiritual? And he said, it's all spiritual. He described it as, he said, look at it this way. What part of a circle is round? Well, that kind of boggled my mind. I thought, wow, it's true. It's a spiritual program. I had a spiritual malady. All the things I thought were wrong with me, I could fix with motorcycles, hot rods, money, women, all these things. None of them filled that hole. I had a hole in me. It was a God-sized hole. Nothing else would fill that hole. I didn't know it. I didn't know it for most of my, until I got sober. I didn't know that's what was missing in me. I can tell you that that hole has been filled. And it remains that way as long as I stay true to these principles and I depend on a power greater than myself. And I live this design for living that we are freely given here. And So we get here early. I got here and said, one of the things that it talks about in We Agnostics, lack of power was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously, but where and how are we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. The main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problems. So I got plenty of problems. So I depend on God for that, for the guidance and for the strength to face these and deal with anything that comes along in my life. And I will tell you, we used to be told all the time that the same man will drink again. Well, when I got to AA, I had long black hair. I was about 160 pounds. And I'm not the same man today. But more importantly, I'm not just physically not the same man. I will tell you how much I have changed, because none of you knew me when I drank. I went to high school with a guy, and we both got sober years later. And we ended up going to a meeting together up in Herndon. And we would go to dinner, a group of us go to dinner before the meeting. And one evening we're at dinner, and he said to me, he looks right across the table, he said, "You know, Mike, I'm at the high school with a guy named Mike Steele." And I'm thinking, what is the hell is he, what the heck is he talking about? And I said, "Well, Chuck, you know, I'm Mike Steele." He said, "No, no, no." He said, "You're not Mike Steele that I knew." I said, "Well, I'm pretty sure that I'm the same guy, because," I said, "did you date that guy's sister?" "Yeah." "Did you go to his house and drink beer?" "Yeah." I said, "I'm him, man." He said, "I can't believe that's you." He said, "I'm not even talking about how you look." He said, "You're not the same person you were." And I took that as a compliment, because I couldn't afford to be the same person I was, or I'd have gone back to my old way of life. And I had to change. And thank God I did. I was willing to. When we get beat down enough, we're going to change. We're going to change. At least I couldn't take it anymore. I thought I was tough. Alcoholism will beat you down. It'll take everything you have before it kills you. I've seen it. I've seen it in my own family. I've seen it in friends. One of my best friends never drew a sober breath since he was 16 years old, and he died drunk in his mother's basement. He wasted a life. He never had a girlfriend, a job, a car. He lived in his mother's basement his entire life and drank. That's it. That's what he did. Sounds unbelievable, but that's exactly what he did. And then he died. I don't want to live a life like that. Alcohol, AA has given me a life that I didn't even want. I didn't even want that. I didn't know I didn't. I just knew when I was drinking, I ran with, as I said, some shady characters, as my mother described them. We rode motorcycles. We had a lot of parties. We had a lot of fun. But there was also the downside, the dark side of that. And so when I started getting sober, I didn't take to this right away. I didn't say, "Oh God, I'm going to have to be responsible." All these things. I didn't just say hallelujah, as I said, but it came on me. This change this whole change. I love every minute of it. I love my life. I love AA. I love the people in AA. I will go to any length to help anybody to get sober. And it's because that's what they did for me. And it's because that assures my sobriety. And so there is, I would just tell you that if you, hopefully that you get the message that I don't care if you're struggling, if you're not sure about this thing, if I haven't connected with you much, if you haven't connected with my story, then you just go to some more meetings, because somebody's going to tell your story. And I was told that early on, and I found that to be true. People have told my story, and I have come to believe that in AA, as it says, in as their solution, that we have this new life, and it's a design for living. You know, I can tell you, I was a confrontational person, to say the least. Well, I knew I was changing when a number of years ago, I like to go to the movies, and I like to go by myself because I don't want to talk to anybody. And the ladies I know like to talk in the meetings. I mean, in the movies. So I don't take it. So, and I don't want to share my big poppy. So I'm at this meeting. I'm at this movie, and I leave. And there's hardly anybody there in a great big parking lot. So I don't stay between the lines when I leave. I kind of cut across. And there's one car, and I go by him, and he hollers out the window, "You butthole." But it wasn't that nice. I slammed on the brakes because, remember, I'm confrontation. I slammed her up in reverse. That truck was squealing tires back to him, and it hit me. 75 years old. I wasn't then, but I wasn't that far off of it. And I said, "What am I doing?" I backed up and I said, "Hey, that's Mr. Butthole." And I went down the road. I saw no sense in something that stupid getting me out of my truck, in jail. At the worst, it's going to ruin one of our days, and probably both. And I thought, I mean, at the best, rather. I said, I'm a different person. I don't take the bait. I don't live that way anymore. And I want to wrap this thing up in just a second here. I have four daughters, as I said. Those four daughters had very little to do with me in my first several years of sobriety. One of my daughters did not escape this disease. She is now sober about 9 years in AA, not because of me, except that I did set an example for her. She knew what to do. But she didn't come to, she didn't call me. I can tell you that. She called one of her sisters. She said, you know what she said. And I can't tell you how my heart swells over that, that she's sober. She's leading a good life. She's taking responsibility for herself, the things that we do in AA. And today, I was at home thinking about this meeting, and another one of my daughters came by the house and spent the afternoon talking. My daughters didn't have anything to do with me. Now they all check in on me because, as I said, I live alone and I still do stupid things. And so they'll check on me, they call me. I'm invited to every family function. They miss me when I don't show up. I'm a part of their life today. I'm no longer a nuisance to society, which I certainly was. I don't think I was a danger to society necessarily, except I drove drunk every day, other than that. But I wasn't robbing banks. But I am no longer a nuisance to society. And it's given me a life that only God could have planned out for me. And I'm convinced that as long as I stay on this path, I will continue to have a wonderful life that is full of joy. It's full of happiness. It's indescribable to me. And I mean, I can't describe this life that I live today to you to sufficiently get that message across. You have to experience it. And you experience it by working the steps, working with other alcoholics, and living these principles. So with that, I'm going to wrap it up. I thank you all for inviting me, for Dale, for inviting me, and for y'all for having me. And I hope that I got a message through that anybody can get sober. Anybody can get sober, and you can lead a wonderful life if you just give it up. Give up the battle. Thank you. Yeah.